Good afternoon. We're calling the meeting of the State Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:31 p.m. on Thursday, March 9th. Also, let the record show that we have a quorum to do business. Present are Senator Diesel, Senator Wilson, Senator Egan, Senator Coghill, and myself, Senator Dunleavy. The purpose of today's meeting is to hear HB 16, driver's license requirement, disability ID and training, prime sponsor Representative Thompson, SCR 4, Task Force on Unmanned Aircraft Systems, prime sponsor Senator Hughes, and we're going to be hearing again SB 48, insurance for dependents of deceased fire police, prime sponsor Senator Coghill. We're going to start with HB 16, driver's license requirement, disability ID and training. Representative Thompson, if you can state your name for the record and begin your testimony, or excuse me, introduction of your bill, that would be great.
Thank you. I'm Steve Thompson. I represent House District 2 up in Fairbanks. And thank you, Chairman Senator Dunleavy and House Senate State Affairs Committee for hearing House Bill 16 today. House Bill 16 came about several years ago when we had the disabled community in Fairbanks came to us and said that they had some concerns of some not good outcomes of relations and interfacing with public safety officials and misunderstandings because of hidden disabilities, non-apparent disabilities. We've had some bad outcomes around the state of Alaska from things like this. So the purpose of the bill is to improve communications between law enforcement and public safety officials and people with these non-apparent and hidden disabilities. The bill has three major components. First is the training for Alaska peace officers, corrections officers, and other officers who interact directly with the public. The second part is the Department of Motor Vehicles handbook to include a section about drivers' responsibilities when interacting with officers in a traffic stop. This will increase safety for officers and the public. And the third part is the statewide voluntary identification system placed on Alaska IDs or driver's licenses to indicate a hidden disability. And this would be a purely voluntary. If somebody didn't want that insignia on their driver's license, they would not have to have it. We've spent about 4 years on this bill so far, and the state troopers are now including in their training at the State Trooper Academy training for people to recognize people with disabilities and how they should be handled. The other part was the motor vehicle driver's license handbook. There was about a dozen of us sitting around the table discussing all these problems. The disabled community was represented with non-disabled people that were sitting there. And we talked about how that a person with a non-apparent disability would be stopped by a police officer and they don't know what to do and they get rather nervous and it will exacerbate maybe their problem. So what do we do? How do we train those people so they know what to do and how to react? Well, 12 people around the table that didn't have disabilities said, well, what are you supposed to do? And all 12 people said, I haven't got a clue. So we talked about this. We talked to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and they said there are multiple states that have a section in their driver's manuals that tells you what your responsibility or what you're supposed to do if you're stopped by a police officer or you have an interaction with the public safety people. It just made sense, and they said they have no problem or no cost to put that into the driver's manual. So that was another part. And then there was an international, I believe you have it in your packets, the symbol that would go on the driver's license if somebody wants to have it on there. Again, this is purely voluntary. So those are the three components that we put into the bill. And if you have any questions, I have my staff with me for technical questions, and thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for members of the committee for Representative Thompson? Senator Wilson, and then Senator Coghill.
Thank you. Well, Representative Thompson, I have a little concern upon some of the voluntary aspects of this bill, meaning that most folks with that may have some elements that are listed here of what qualifies as for the disabled may have payees or conservators of them that may require them to say, oh, you know, I want to put this on this driver's license, or they may be asked by their medical providers, well, you know, you should put this on your license and sort of be coerced into doing this. How is there any stop measures and gaps to prevent some of that to occur from sort of those folks that are the vulnerable population that this would most be beneficial for, to have that be voluntary for them instead of having sort of that they themselves have to go? Or if it's someone that has a conservatorship, do they have the capabilities of being voluntary to have this on their license?
It's totally a voluntary. If somebody, through the chair, thank you, Senator Wilson, it's totally a voluntary. If somebody is advised by the disabled community, the governor's commission on disabilities puts the word out to these people, they would have to go to their medical provider and get a letter stating what their disability is. They would have to take it to the Department of Motor Vehicles and say, I do have this problem and I would like to have this on my license. I didn't think that there would be any coercion as far as forcing them to. If somebody was in a conservatorship, I don't know if they would be eligible to have a driver's license. But this is also to have it on any state ID in case they didn't have a driver's license, or even any kind of identification that might come from a village corporation or something. If that's their only form of identification, that they would have the ability, with proof that they have a problem, that it would be available to them to put on their identification.
Follow-up, Senator?
Yes. No.
Excuse me. Senator Coghill, and then Senator Giesel.
Thank you. So is this up to DMV to establish the protocol that will be put into a driver's manual and tested? Is it something that is taken off the shelf? Tell me a little bit about how that was developed. Question number one. Question number two is, the state troopers have been doing this, but you also have some police academies in Alaska. Help me understand what these other police academies have been doing.
Yes, they have developed an online ability to produce this for police departments, for Fairbanks Police Department, for VPSOs, where that they can do this online and learn and read what the heck the responsibilities are for them to do if they have this, if they encounter this insignia on an identification. So that would be the way that the police would get there. Excuse me, Senator, I didn't say through the chair. Anyway, there is a protocol that they have put together that will have that training, and I feel like it's pretty well set up. It isn't distributed statewide at this time, but most of the larger police departments do go through the state trooper training or the academy to get their certification. And I feel like we got a pretty good start on it.
Senator Cocktail.
Just to follow up on that. So there's two sides of this when a trooper stops somebody. There's my right as a citizen to assert my right, and then there's the right of public safety to actually stop and deal with somebody. And I understand this part, but you went into a whole different area of establishing something that would go into a driver's test and manual. So those two sides of the question come up. Had you heard from DMV how they might deal with those? Because I think that somewhere along the line we're going to bump up against that.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Coghill, we have spoke with DMV several times, and we, through our letters of support, are these in their packet? We have had a lot of reaction and response, and other states have gone through this process as far as what they put in their driver's manuals, and they have came up with pretty simple explanations, and it's for the safety of the police officer as well as the safety for the person. They tell you not to get stopped and you start digging in your glove box. He doesn't know if you're getting a gun or what, so he's going to react. He tells you, don't do that yet. Wait until you have the communications. what a driver should do during an enforcement stop. Acknowledge the officer's presence by turning on your right turn signal or left. Move your vehicle to the right shoulder of the road. On a freeway, move completely onto the right shoulder of the road. End your cell phone conversation and turn off your radio. Remain inside your vehicle unless otherwise directed by the officer. Place your hands in clear view, including all passengers' hands, such as on the steering wheel or on top of your lap. You know, these are the different things that they have put into some of these driver's manuals in multiple states, Montana, Texas, Pennsylvania, and several others. And it's just a good thing for all of us to know what to do.
Sure.
Because a lot of people get an anxiety attack when they see a light flashing in their rearview mirror.
Can appreciate that. Thank you.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Thompson, I don't remember the details of it, but there was an exemplary incident that occurred in Fairbanks a few years back that actually illustrates the importance of your legislation. Do you remember that incident, and can you relate it to the committee?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I've heard of several, and I'm not sure if this is the one in Fairbanks, but there was a person stopped by a police officer. He had very slurred language. He had a hard time communicating, and the police officer's immediate reaction was to drag him out of the car, throw him up against the side of the car, and handcuff him because he thought he was drunk. He wasn't. But he got hauled in, and then they got him to the police station. They put in an order to confiscate his car. And they then found out that he was not inebriated. And they had quite a long process, though, to get through that. There was another incident that happened in Kodiak last year, I believe, where a gentleman had gone down to the mailbox, and the police officer stopped because they thought he might have been react or somebody stealing mail or something, and the guy didn't know how to react to the police officer. This wasn't in a vehicle, but he was shot with a taser, you know, because of a misunderstanding of the guy has a handicap, and I don't remember what his was. But, you know, incidents like that is what we're trying to prevent from happening.
Thank you. Follow-ups, Mr. Chairman? So I've also heard the argument, well, couldn't we just put this indication, this designation on the license plate of the vehicle? Why does it have to be on a driver's license?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, the indication on the driver's license plate is for somebody that has a mobility disability that gives them permission to park in a handicapped spot at a grocery store or somewhere. I don't think that this would qualify for somebody getting a handicap on their license plate. A lot of people would, with a undetectable handicap, would probably not want that on their license plate because they don't feel handicapped, they don't think they are, and they don't want anybody to be pointing at them with what's wrong with you type of a reaction.
Senator Giesel?
Thank you. And just to follow up on that, as someone that was the sponsor of the ABLE Act last year, there are many very able-bodied individuals who have other types of disabilities, and they don't regard themselves as physically impaired for mobility purposes. But one last follow-up, Mr. Chairman. This is not, as you commented, the first time this bill has gone through this legislature. What level of support did it have last year? What was the impediment to it being passed?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, it passed the House last year 40-0. It came to the Senate, and I believe it went through two committees in the Senate, and it was approved and passed. And this is a crazy year last year where we had so much going on, and it got to Senate rules and never got to the Senate floor. So that's the process what has happened in the history of it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Egan and then Senator Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just I have one of these disabilities that are on this list, and I qualify for a handicap parking sticker and through my physician, and but I don't want it on my license plate because I don't want to, unless I absolutely have to because of my mobility problems, really don't want people to say, well, you know, I just don't want it. So that's why I have my sticker. I don't want it to stay that way. But I just wanted to say that I have one of these, and somebody may think it's a possible conflict. Personally, I don't, but I just wanted to point it out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Egan, that's exactly what was brought to us by several people that have handicaps. They said, we don't want it pointed out. We don't want it on mine. But some people do want it so that they don't have a bad reaction or bad interaction with public safety.
Thank you. Senator Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, going through some of those lists of some considered hidden disabilities, I would say this is the majority of the population in general. You know, everything from allergies to food allergies to chronic pain to diabetes. I mean, there's a long list here, and I don't want to see this being abused by anyone who, because like I said, I think most of the people in this room would qualify for at least something on this list. With that, I'm also worried upon employers who people need to use their driver's license for more than just identification to have on the road. They use it for different identifications, for I-9, for employment. It could be used for that. It could be used for different areas. And people thus may be just treated differently or be or use this as a way for some type of other types of discrimination based upon this identification. With that, I'm all for the first part of the bill. I do believe law enforcement, regardless if you have a disability or not, needs to be a little bit more better trained upon recognizing some of the folks with disabilities and more folks. But the reality of it, and I just don't know if you have the statistics or maybe it's something I should look up for law enforcement. They weren't able to answer this question from state troopers, is that when they're encountering someone that may be going through a severe episode of psychosis, having some issue on a far spectrum of autism and the Asperger syndrome, most likely, and I don't know the stats, that they're already in handcuffs, and by the time they pull out the wallet to see that this person is disabled because of the acting out behaviors that may be being displayed, it's a little too late for that. So the first part of this, the curriculum requirements, I'm very, very for that. But once we get into labeling and having folks use this as a crutch of having on their license, I think that's a little too identifying that we started getting these subpopulations. But the treatment and the, like I said, the training part of this and having the pieces in the handbooks and the DMV, I'm all for. But just the portion of the license piece, I'm having a little bit of difficulty overcoming this.
Any comments?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I was shocked at the list that we received from the disabled community that listed all of those. I think that some of them probably shouldn't qualify for having that stamp on their driver's license, but I'm not a medical doctor or a person that could determine which should and which should not be, and I don't know what we would have to do. I don't know if the doctor or if the DMV would be able to address something along these lines or not. But, yeah, that's quite an extensive list that we were provided with.
Follow-up?
Not this time, no.
Okay, thank you. Senator Giesel?
Representative Thompson, just to reiterate, this is a voluntary indicator on a license. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, that is correct.
Thank you. And follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Excuse me. Yes.
So an individual that had seasonal allergies, let's say, would certainly have that option to not have this on their driver's license. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, that is correct.
Thank you.
Questions from members of the committee? We are going to hear some invited testimony on this bill. We're first going to go to, and I hope I can pronounce your name correctly. If not, please correct me. Art Delari from Fairbanks, Alaska. Are you online? Is Art Delari online?
Yes, I'm here.
If you could pronounce your name or state your name for the record and who you're with, and then you can begin your testimony on this bill, that'd be great.
You had it fairly correct. It's Art DeLon, I'm in Fairbanks, and I represent Wallbusters, and I'm also a member of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. And I'm here just to answer any questions that may arise.
Okay, I'm sorry. Any questions for Mr. DeLon? Senator Giesel.
Mr. DeLon, do you support this bill?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Next, we will go to Juanita Webb. Juanita, are you online?
I am, thank you.
Can you state your name for the record, who you're with, and begin your testimony?
My name is Juanita Webb, and I represent Wallbusters, which is an advocacy group based out of Fairbanks, Alaska. And I live in Fox, Alaska. I'd like to thank Senator Dunleavy and the State Affairs Committee for hearing my testimony on the HB 16. I'd also like to thank Representative Thompson for sponsoring the bill and going on this journey with the Wallbusters. Although this bill has been a long process, I and my fellow Wallbusters have learned so much about the process, and we have a greater appreciation for the job you have all accepted. You should have received a personal letter of support from me with my own personal story and how the bill could have potentially made a difference. I won't repeat that letter. But for me, HB 16 has always been about safety and standardized education. Giving new incoming officers at the academy level a more complete understanding of disabilities with standardized training, about both visible and hidden disabilities, will give the officers one more added tool to help guide their interactions accordingly. Having a discrete, voluntary icon on a driver's license or ID gives us additional information to alert the officers to potential further communication needs for a better outcome. And, of course, that always comes after the safety of the individual and the police officers. As the bill comes to life, we realize the added need to educate others as well, and Wallbusters realize not only people with disabilities were unsure of their responsibilities when approached by an officer, but many people in general were unsure of what to do. Adding the additional information in the DMV manual helps support this need. I respect the support and support police officers and proud to be part of a bill to help educate them in their approach to our Alaskan citizens and at the same time help their jobs become safer so they can return home to their families each evening. This bill is not only for people with disabilities, but all Alaskans. Through training and standardized education, our lives will be safer and more informed. And I thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak, and I ask you to support and pass HB 16.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Webb from members of the committee? Seeing none, thank you. Next we go to Kathy Gerby up in Fairbanks as well. Are you online?
I am.
Can you state your name for the record and begin your testimony?
Hi, my name is Kathy Gerby, and I am a licensed clinical social worker with 29 years of experience working with clients who have experienced a vast array of hidden disabilities. I am also the proud mother of three children, two of whom experienced hidden physical disabilities. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of HB 16. When I worked at Access Alaska, I attended the Christmas party for our deaf consumers, and one deaf consumer was reportedly suicidal. I sat with my staff, who was an interpreter, and this consumer. I will never forget our interaction. She looked most terrified at the thought of going to the hospital, and this was more terrifying to her than going home. We spoke for a while, and she agreed she would talk to me again if the despair did not lighten up. I told her she was important to me, and that was true, and it continues to be true. The isolation and misunderstanding that deaf people experience is heightened by the communication challenges and our ignorance of deaf culture. In the mental health realm, there's a statistic I read that 60% of deaf patients are likely misdiagnosed due to the lack of providers who can communicate and understand their experiences. This adds another layer of trauma for many deaf people. HB 16 has come before the legislature in several forms over the last 4 years. This bill is about empowering people with hidden disabilities to be supported in identifying themselves under times of duress to first responders. This bill keeps coming back before you all because it is about the people, your constituents. This bill has no fiscal note. The Trooper Training Academy has already amended their training program to incorporate a more robust training regarding disabilities, thanks to the hard work and partnership of my colleagues of Wallbusters and the dedicated advocates at Access Alaska. The remaining step is for the legislature to finally approve this bill so that there is a freedom of choice for individuals experiencing disabilities to who have a small identification placed on their identification to support them should they become involved with first responders. The identification on the license will also support the responder to know that a few additional moments may be required for a human being who is struggling. I could speak about the number of times that a first responder has struggled or made a poor or lethal choice regarding someone with a hidden disability. I could share stories of training my clients to advocate for themselves and speak their truths regarding their brain injury, autism, developmental disabilities, or mental illness because they had failed to do so in previous situations with first responders. This symbol on the driver's license may help bridge a gap of shame for some. In a time where finances are dominating the legislative discussion again, this is a bill with no fiscal note that supports your constituents who have patiently come back here over the last 4 years. It is time to pass this bill. Whether the person has a severe mental illness, a traumatic brain injury, a hearing impairment, autism, fetal alcohol spectrum, this bill and the process to getting here before the legislature has resulted in excellent statewide cooperation, changes to the police training curriculum, and a robust debate regarding the option for choice of a symbol on a driver's license. It is your turn as legislators to bring the circle to completion and to support the people who are back again testifying. I appreciate your support for people with disabilities who are requesting the option of an accommodation to support them to live more independently in their communities, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify again in support of this bill.
Thank you. Next, we have Darrell McBurney, also in Fairbanks. Can you state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please? Thank you.
Yes, Darrell McBurney. I am here with Wallbusters in Fairbanks. I formerly was on the Governor's Committee for Employment of People with Disabilities. And although that is disbanded, there were several groups that had that we had put together and to minimize groups overlapping each other. I broke my back here in April. It'll be 26 years. I get to watch a lot of cop movies and actual takedowns. My biggest problem, I think, is if you have a vanity tag on your license plate and you cannot walk, I think, I'm not sure exactly if they're tied into, when I say they, the license plates are on the vehicle, and then if the trooper or the city will punch up your license, if there is anything on there that will say, hey, I'm disabled, versus the fact of, you know, them saying, step out of your car. Obviously, those with disabilities sometimes fit in that category. But if you can't get out of your car and do things, I mean, they're on you pretty fast. I just hope that we can get this House bill settled finally. It's been 4 years. It's time to get it done. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we're moving on to Richard Webb. Mr. Webb, are you online?
I am.
Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
I'm Richard Webb. I'm a legally blind individual, and I am 100% behind HB 16, and I ask that that you pass this so that it can go on to the next committee and eventually become law. It's an important bill. It's voluntary for the person with a disability, and I've just heard, I could be here for a week telling you all of the stories that I've heard of interactions with people with a disability and law enforcement, regardless of whether they're a perpetrator, a witness, you know, whatever, and the misunderstandings. And it has a zero fiscal note. and in my opinion, it's going to save a lot of money, you know, down the road, because of the training that the law enforcement will get, so they'll understand, you know, that some people don't communicate in the way or comprehend in the way of the majority. And anyway, so I ask that you pass this and support it. And I thank you for the tough job you guys have. And this is, you know, in this fiscal times when we're struggling with our budget, this isn't going to cost us anything and is likely to save us a lot. And so I hope that you'll support it. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to open public testimony at this time. Is there anybody online under public testimony that wishes to testify? Is there anybody here in Juneau that wishes to testify upon this bill? Seeing none, we're going to close public testimony. We will place the bill off the side, and we'll hear it in one of our next meetings, and we'll notify you when that will be scheduled. We're going to take a quick ease and transition over to our next bill. Back in session, we're now moving on to our next item, which is SCR-4, Task Force on Unmanned Aircraft Systems. Senator Hughes is the prime sponsor of SCR-4. She is here today to present the resolution. Senator Hughes, can you state your name for the record and with your staff as well, and then introduce your resolution?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Shelley Hughes, Senator for District F, Chugiak, Palmer. And as I was preparing to come to you today, I realized that for four of you, you have had five unmanned aircraft bills or resolutions, so you're probably pretty much up to speed. But for the newest member, he hasn't yet heard the full amount. But for sake of time, I'd be happy to meet with Senator Wilson through the chair to bring him up to speed if he'd like. But just to give a brief background, I first came aware of this industry because constituents came to me concerned about privacy, and they were asking me to propose legislation to ban unmanned aircraft in our state. And looking at that and my research, I realized that these could be really useful tools if the operator had good intentions. And so thus the journey began, and we established in 2013 a task force, and I've co-chaired that for 4 years. And during that time, we have done a lot of good work with a great team of volunteers, a good membership, and they've stuck with it. And so we feel like there is more work to do because we've really done a lot to help educate the public about the safety and the privacy guidelines. In fact, there is a document that we worked on as a task force to get out to the public. But one of the things that and we've also done a lot to really promote the aviation industry and for the wonderful and many cost savings and life-saving uses of unmanned aircraft. But one of the things that we are still struggling with, Mr. Chair, is the issue of privacy. And from time to time, we are notified of instances in our state. And we've had many discussions with law enforcement about this issue, and we've come up with different ideas at different times, and then we realize that we run up against FAA rules and regulations because, if you don't know it, here's news that the air right above the blade of grass in your background or the snowflake in your backyard is actually controlled by the FAA. So we are still looking at that issue of privacy. We do have an idea that we'd like to explore more, and right now we're going to term out at June 30th. And so the task force has decided that we need to stay in existence until we get through this time of transition for this new evolving technology. So that's what the resolution is. It is to re-up the task force. These are all volunteers, no compensation, no travel. We'll be meeting by teleconference, or if people choose to come together, they would pay their own expenses. So my staff is here and can answer any questions. We also have several of our members of the task force online who can answer technical questions. We have Steve Culligan. We have Steve Wachowski. We have John, and I'm probably going to butcher his name because his nickname is Nevada, but it might be he can pronounce it. Nevadomsky, perhaps, is pronounced, and I should know that because he's one of the task force members. And then we also have Mike O'Hare with Military and Veterans Affairs. So they're all online. If you have any particular questions about what's happening in our state in regard to the uses, they're very knowledgeable and would be happy to answer your questions.
Questions from members of the committee for Senator Hughes on SCR 4. I have a question, Senator. You made a statement, and it just struck me as kind of interesting. And you said the space above your yard or your grass doesn't belong to us, it belongs to them. This may sound like a silly question. And so you're in your back field, let's say, and all of a sudden you see something scurrying right across the top of the grass towards your house. And let's say, not the landowner, of course, but somebody else takes a shot at it, or you have a dog that takes it down and wrecks it. Are we responsible? Is that something that's an illegal act on our part? If I understand if something's at 30,000 feet, but if it's right above the ground and it's in your space, are you saying you, as a landowner, you cannot do anything to stop that or protect yourself from that?
Just to clarify, if I said own the airspace, they control it, they have jurisdiction over it, just to be clear. And this might answer your question, but the most often, the most frequent question I am asked about drones is, can I shoot one down if it flies over my house? And actually the answer is you would be in violation of federal law if you did. So that is one of the things. That's why education is really important. And, you know, some of these pieces of equipment, from a distance, it may look like something you get off the shelf at Best Buy, but it may be a $50,000 drone, you know, a very highly technical piece of equipment. So we try to tell people, just, you know, you might be in trouble if you do that. It's someone else's property.
I know there's an answer to this. So someone like myself, let's say that has horses and there's a drone flying around the horses and running the horses through the fence, I just stand there and I just watch this happen because this is not my airspace, even though the activity of that drone may be thoroughly disrupting my life.
And, you know, I would suggest we ask some of the folks online. I would suggest that you do is I'd start waving it away, because they have cameras on them and they can see you and they can tell that you don't want them there.
So, thank you. I think we'll go out. I think we will we'll ask if there's further questions from the committee for yourself, Senator, at this stage of the game, and then we'll move on to invited testimony here in just a moment. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I am aware that these UAVs were used to count sea lions out in the Aleutians. These are very sensitive animals to any kind of disruption. In fact, if they even spot a human any distance away, they dive into the water, making it impossible to count them. So how successful was that in terms of being able to count those sea lions, and have you any data about whether creatures such as horses or mules would be frightened by a UAV?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, and I would suggest when Nevada, if you're listening to Nevada, when you testify that you respond to that, because I know that at UAF, They were involved with that, but I will tell you that they're getting more accurate counts using drones or unmanned aircraft than they are with manned aircraft, which are noisy and at a farther distance. So in general, I think the UAVs, UAS, work better than manned aircraft, and they do have data, and they did see a difference when they started using unmanned aircraft for the count. In fact, I think it maybe helped, and Nevada can speak particularly, but may have avoided some animals even going on endangered species lists because they're getting more accurate counts.
Okay, so there is a zero fiscal note attached to this. We're going to go to we're going to open this up for public testimony, and we do have folks online. I'm going to go first to Steve Culligan up in Wasilla. Mr. Culligan, are you online? You might have to unmute your phone or speaker wherever you're at.
Sorry, I am online and I had my phone muted because I'm in a very noisy area, out of town.
So, state your name for the record, Mr. Culligan.
This is Steve Culligan, C-O-L-L-I-G-A-N, a resident of Wasilla, Alaska, business owner, Anchorage, Alaska.
Okay, and you are with Unmanned Aircraft Systems Task Force, is that correct?
I am a previous current member of the task force. I'm a professional operator, licensed operator, but also represent the Academy of Model Aeronautics, Government Relations for Alaska, a volunteer position.
Thank you. Hey, Mr. Culligan, can you help with the question I asked? I mean, it may have sounded silly to some degree, but Senator Hughes mentioned that anything above, I'm going to say the ground, is airspace that does not belong to the landowner. If there's, what are the laws or rules regarding unmanned aircraft in terms of harassment? I mentioned that, I have horses, and if there is a drone flying around the horses and runs them through the fence, I mean, what recourse do I have, or what prohibitions are there against certain activities by these unmanned aircraft?
So some of that is dependent state to state, but the reality is nationwide, as Ms. Hughes, Senator Hughes represented, airspace is controlled by the FAA. The distinction, number one, I think, in the current law, without getting into technical details, is the idea is it is classified by the FAA as an aircraft, just like a full-size aircraft. And in some cases, when you're talking about harassment and the like, it doesn't matter whether it's an aircraft or you put your smartphone on a broomstick and you just bought it at the hardware store, et cetera. It's the act, not necessarily the flying. And to the public, there's a what's called that we consider perceived level of privacy. And that's what kind of gets debated in the public. But the reality is, it doesn't matter whether it's a phone or whatever, or it's a drone. People like to get very dramatic about the descriptions, but the reality is it's the act, not necessarily the device. But as far as an aircraft, it is an aircraft. So when you shoot it down, there are other repercussions that come into play since the FAA has determined that they're aircraft, not model airplanes anymore. And that's some of the things we're wrestling through in the public. The reality, and even in Anchorage, they're going through an ordinance to limit at 50 feet above somebody's property, which is a little bit in conflict with some of the FAA airspace rules. But the reality is public safety and people need some devices to be able to protect the public if somebody is behaving poorly. Doesn't matter, again, whether it's from a drone or some other device. And there are laws on the books from peeping toms and voyeurism, et cetera, that are covered. But in reality, that's what's been great about the task force is reviewing the first things in every meeting are privacy and public safety. But then furthermore, the first effort of the task force is working with the state attorney general to review our existing laws. And there's one that we've been trying to get through since last year, was the idea of a definition of loitering. So if you're in this space, in the airspace, and you're loitering over somebody's property, and that's the act, that there's something for public safety to be able to talk to the operator about, et cetera. But it gets to be a fine line between the law in the airspace and the act that an individual person that's misbehaving is doing.
Okay, thank you. Just one last question. When it comes to manned aircraft, usually there's numbers, visible numbers on the plane itself for identification in case, you know, something occurs. Some of these drones are so small, if you can't see the visible number, how do you report, let's say, illegal activity or some form of harassment?
So that is an issue. So they're supposed to be visibly, when you sign for a professional operation, and even the FAA has a hobbyist registration, everything over essentially 250 grams or half a pound, you need to put your registration number on your aircraft. And try and make it as largely visible as possible. But just like I said, on a pound or 2 pound or 4 pound or even 8 pound unmanned systems, especially when they're multi-rotors and the like and have thin legs on them, it is not that easy to make them very large or much larger than a half inch or 3/4 inch. There are other electronic means to broadcast your numbers, et cetera, especially if you have video, if you're long-range video transmitting, you follow the FCC rules and the like, but that is a current issue. Senator Dunleavy, is that some of these are so small that even if you do legally have a registration number on them, it's hard to see from more than, you know, 25, 30 feet away.
Thank you, and I know that this is about a task force, which I appreciate. I just some of these questions come up. Does anyone in the committee have a question for Mr. Culligan? Seeing none, we also have online Mike O'Hara with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Steve Wachowski with the UAS Task Force out of Anchorage, John Novadonsky, I hope I pronounced that correctly, UAS Task Force Fairbanks, and Brian Duffy, Administrative Director of Military and Veteran Affairs, Anchorage. Are there any questions for any of these individuals from members of the committee regarding this issue of the task force? Seeing none, public testimony is now closed. We do have an amendment to the bill, and I'm going to move the amendment. And this is amendment number one, and it is for SCR 4. I move amendment number one.
Mr. President, or Mr. Chairman, I object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you. So on page 3, I'm going to ask Mr. Witt if he would identify himself for the record to speak to the amendment.
Thank you, Chair Dunleavy. For the record, my name is Buddy Witt, staff to Senator Shelley Hughes. It was brought to our attention on page 3 of SCR 4. This would be on lines 29, 30, and 31. There was some open-ended language by specifying that the public and industry members of the task force serve without compensation and are not entitled to per diem or reimbursement of travel expenses by designating only public and industry members of the task force to be exempt. It therefore did not exempt any other members of the task force. The advice was to remove the words public and industry, and therefore make all members of the task force that they would be exempt from compensation or per diem during their duties on the task force, and therefore result in a fiscal note. Otherwise, it would have been indeterminate.
With that explanation, is the objection maintained?
I remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any further objections to this amendment, number one? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Are there any more amendments for members of the committee? Seeing none, is there a motion to move Senate Concurrent Resolution number 4?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 4, Version 30LS0360/alpha, from committee with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
Any objections from members of the committee to move this resolution? Seeing none, we will be moving SCR 4 to the next SCR 4 Version A out of committee to the next committee of referral, and with that, we'll take a brief at ease. This is the Senate State Affairs. We're back out of brief recess, and we're moving on to our next and last item, SB 48, Insurance for Dependents of Deceased Fire Police. There is a new committee substitute for consideration. Senator Giesel?
Mr. Chairman, I move the work draft for CS Senate Bill number 48, State Affairs, version 30LS0108/uniform, before the committee.
Thank you, and I'll object for discussion. I'll have staff, Krista McDonald, explain the changes of the CS for SB 48.
For the record, Krista McDonald, staff to Senator Dunleavy. This CS version U has two changes. First, you'll see on page 2, lines 25 to 29, there's new language added to 39.60.040A that requires an application be submitted to the commissioner but presumes the eligibility of the surviving dependent. This was language that was requested by Department of Law just to make sure that the application process is smooth, and it still removes the gap but allows them to have that application on file. And then page 6, lines 16 to 17, has been reworded for clarification. So now it will read, surviving spouse means a person who was married to an employee at the time of the employee's death. This doesn't change the meaning, just kind of cleaned up some of the words there.
So I'm going to remove my objection. Is there further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, the CS for SB 48 has been adopted. Excuse me, Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 48 version U is adopted. Online we have, it is open for public discussion, and we do have online Brandy Johnson. Ms. Johnson, are you online?
Yes, fine.
Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, for the record, my name is Brandy Johnson. I am testifying in support of Senate Bill 48 on behalf of myself, my three daughters, my deceased husband, Scott Johnson, surviving families of past and future, line of duty death state troopers, as well as law enforcement officers in the state of Alaska. On May 1st, 2014, my husband, Scott Johnson and Gaybridge, were murdered while in performance of their job as Alaska state troopers in Tanana, Alaska. The recent committee substitute to Senate Bill 48 currently limits the health coverage to surviving spouses to 10 years on page 3, line 20. I was wondering if the 10-year limit on spousal coverage is retroactive to the death of the employee, or if the 10-year limit begins when the legislation would take effect. I also would like information on what the reasoning is behind the limit. Why is the limit 10 years and not 5 or even 15, et cetera? Is the language coming from similar language from what another state may be doing? Usually when a family purchases health care coverage or the coverage is part of an employee benefit, it is a family package. The parents' coverage usually covers the children. Me being the sole surviving parent, it is my responsibility to take care of my family. The limiting language, it doesn't make sense to me. I'm hearing it is more important to take care of the children rather than the family unit. When a law enforcement officer is killed in the line of duty, the surviving families are at all different stages of life. Some families are very young while others are older. Also, if the 10-year language remains, I would like to know what the additional cost would be to cover the remaining surviving parent after the 10-year limit expires. Currently, there are two surviving spouses of Alaska State Trooper employees who have been killed in the line of duty and one surviving spouse of a municipal employee that was killed in the line of duty. I would think the state of Alaska would want to take care of the sole surviving parent so that that parent can take care of their family. Thank you for the special invitation today to testify on behalf of this committee substitute and address my concerns.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. We're going to close public testimony, but we're going to have Senator Coghill respond to the questions that you asked. Senator Coghill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And she brings up a good point. So we did. We looked, first of all, what was introduced by the administration during special session that had the 10-year portion in it. But we thought it was, you know, an arbitrary number. So we looked across the United States to find out how do they deal with this. And I can tell you there's no common way. Some don't deal with it at all. Some have had blank spots like we have. But 10 years was a number that did come up often. I'm certainly open to suggestion on this. I had thought of a way to modify it down through those years. That's gets a little more complicated. So I just stuck with how the administration, Department of Law, originally came up with it. It does seem somewhat arbitrary. I'll give you that, but it's generous notwithstanding. It's not a lifelong benefit, and so like I say, I'm open to discussion on it. We did try to make sure that the youngsters got up to age 26 unless there was some other benefit available to them. I think as we enter into this kind of new policy world, we're just trying to figure out how do you do it as deliberately as you can, and watch how it works. So I don't have any better answer than that. We're just trying to figure out how to manage it the best we knew how. And so, like I say, I'm open to discussion on it, but that's where the administration started. That's where other states end up more often than not, although I can tell you there are many states that have just a whole different variation of what we're doing here. So that's as close as I can get to a normal.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for the bill sponsor, Senator Coghill. First of all, though, I want to thank Mrs. Johnson for supporting the bill and for her significant sacrifice for the state of Alaska. Senator Coghill, as I'm looking at this, related to the surviving children, of course, ensuring the insurance coverage for those children until they reach age 26 is in line with what insurance would be for you or I, for our surviving children, or our children even if we were still alive, right? Just could you confirm that this is standard for insurance, health insurance?
It's standard under the mandate that that we live under now, notwithstanding what Congress is doing. But it falls within the reasonable limit of what we're doing here. It does say, though, that if they get a comparable insurance policy, and that's why we had to have a reporting mechanism in there. And if we're going to ask a qualification level, then we have to have a demonstration level, too. So, but that's based on the national policy, basically.
Thank you.
Thank you. Additional questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, is there a motion to move Senate Bill 48 from committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for Senate Bill number 48, version 30LS0108/uniform from this committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. Are there any objections to moving this bill? Seeing none, this bill will be moved on to the next Senate Bill 48, version U, will be moved on to the next committee of referral, which is Finance. We're going to take a brief at ease and sign the documents. back in session. This is Senate State Affairs. It's Tuesday. Excuse me. It's we're going to be. Thank you. It's Thursday. We're going to be adjourning our meeting here shortly. Our next meeting will be Tuesday, March 14th at 3:30 p.m. and we will be hearing confirmation hearings for the Alaska Political Offices Commission, as well as the Alaska Police Standards Council, and we will also be hearing introducing SB 38. Employee pay increases for 2 years. This is a bill through the Rules Committee from the governor regarding pay increases for exempt employees. With that, we're adjourned.